Welcome to Maxed Out Man, helping you become the man you were made to be.
Hey guys, it's Kevin Davis from the Maxed Out Man podcast. This is episode number 38, and I am here with Jody Cedric, who is a good friend of mine. We had an opportunity to do a podcast about a week ago on his Father's Fire podcast. He also does a podcast for Road FS. He is the CEO of Mobility Software and Road FS. CEO of, what's the name of your company?
Zenware is the name of the company.
Man,
we have a product.
Product called Road FS. I am struggling, guys, this morning, you know, talk about telling the truth on these podcast technical issues. I have not had enough of my amino energy caffeine drink this morning. So Jody Cedric, thank you very much for being here. I will let you tell your story because clearly I'm not doing a very good job of it this morning. So I appreciate you taking the time and being here.
You know what? If you can't laugh at yourself, then what's the point?
Well, I've done like 70 or 80 of these now on different podcasts. You think I would know a little bit more about what I'm doing, but obviously I'm still making this crap up as I go along.
You know what? I've done 240 of Father's Fire, and there's still inevitable something that's happened. So
tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do, I'm super interested in your story. We've had an opportunity to visit quite a few times and follow each other on social.
I am the proud husband of a beautiful wife. We've been married almost 35 years in February. We have six beautiful kids, four of which Judy and I had together, and then God brought us two more via the adoption. And so we have a nice rainbow colored family. And our two kids are from Haiti, and my wife's Filipina. And my kids are very proud to be half Filipino and leaning towards the Filipino side. I have a software company, as you said, Zenware. We have a product called Road FS, which is a mobile service application geared, not only for the automotive industry, which you and I play in, but also for other industries. And we also have another product called Harvest Point that is geared towards the agricultural space, where we track the food from the time it was picked all the way to the pack house. And we do a lot of different custom software development projects for people. They come to us with ideas. We have a patient EMR system. We have, just a whole bunch of them. So keeps us pretty busy.
And I want to talk more about fatherhood and all that too, but I'm interested on, is that something that you went to school for? Or is that something you kind of learned? I saw on your Facebook profile that you study Spanish, which I think is interesting. I've actually been trying to learn Spanish. My daughter spent six months in Costa Rica at a Spanish immersion school. And, I've got my Babbel app out, working a little bit here and there, but
that's
good.
That's
an interesting and good skill to have, but
I actually started out when I was younger, I wanted to be a Navy pilot, but they wouldn't let me fly because of my eyes.
Was this after watching Top Gun?
No, that was, dude, you got to remember, I graduated in 83, so
you're about 9 years ahead of me. All of my friends, we were in high school when Top Gun came out, the first one, and it was like everybody wanted to go be a Navy pilot. And what's funny is that one of my good friends is actually, he became a jet fighter pilot, which is, ironic, but anyway.
Yeah, when I was 12, from 8 to 13, my dad was stationed in Pensacola, where the Blue Angels train. And one of the pilots of the Blue Angels was actually in our church. And he spent a lot of time with us young boys. And I just had mad respect for him. He drove a Trans Am. He was just the ultimate cool, right? And I really looked up to him. And when I turned 18, I'm like, all right, I want to go on a mission, but I want to go and talk to the Navy recruiters. And they're like, dude, you have no hope, right? Back then they wouldn't let you fly with corrected vision. And so I'm like, and they're like, well, you know, you tested really high on the language test. You should go be a translator. I'm like, dude, if I'm not flying, I don't want to go in the Navy. So my other interest was, as a kid, I was really infatuated with old time radio. I am a big fan of CBS Radio Mystery Theater, all of those old shows. I love them, right? So I actually went into radio for about 10 years, was a disc jockey, music director in San Francisco, the Bay Area, kind of all around. And in the mid 90s, radio became really hot property. I mean, it was moving hands. In fact, in 1 year, I was at 3 different stations in the same building. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I want this kind of volatility in my life. So Judy and I went to Arizona. I was going to go to flight school. That was a disaster because we took a big leap to Tucson and didn't really do any research. And it was like in the worst depression of Tucson. I couldn't get a job. And so we ended up coming to Boise, Idaho, because our first married friends moved here. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go study Spanish. So that's when I got a degree in Spanish. And while I was in college, my buddy that said, hey, come move to Idaho. He's like, he was really into computers. He goes, we should start a computer magazine. I'm like, dude, I don't like computers. I don't want to have nothing to do with computers. He goes, yeah, but you're a good sales guy. You could be over marketing. And so that's how I got pulled into it. So we started this little business. I was out doing ad sales and marketing. The problem is 3-4 weeks into it, the third partner quit and my poor other guy, Dave, was left building the magazine, doing all the layout and graphic design by himself. So by necessity, I learned. And then this crazy thing called the internet came about around that same time. So I started dabbling in web design, and 20 years later, I'm in computers.
That's crazy. It's funny because it's always interesting to me because I'll meet different people, or I have known different people that I'm friends with, acquainted with. And then I start to hear their stories and I realize how closely the stories will line up in certain ways. And I don't know if that's a God thing or that's just like, these are kind of it steers us towards these decisions because of our interest and our makeup and all that. But, you know, I've lived in Arizona. I worked in my degrees in exercise physiology, and then I have a second one in business. And then I went to work for a software company out east, a startup back in the .com days. And then from there, I opened my own web development company, which I still own and I've had since 1999. And so it's like this, we actually lived in Pocatello, Idaho, the other side of the state. And now I live in Montana. And it's funny how these paths can cross and how those, you know, how life kind of takes you in those different directions. Right.
Yeah. It's been a crazy journey, but you know, I just live and I've always been kind of like you. I'm kind of more entrepreneurial minded, so I tend to be willing to put it all on the table or jump, you know, and I'll build the parachute as it goes, right? I'm very willing to jump on an intuition where a lot of people are like, let's build some pieces before, right? And that served me well, but it's also put me, you know, where I've lost big, but I've also won big too. So I'm willing to put it on the table.
Yeah. And they talk about entrepreneurs being, they have a high degree of tolerance for risk, but which is kind of what you're describing. I tend to be that way, but also I always try to look at the grand scheme from a risk mitigation standpoint.
Yeah, I'm not that guy.
And you're not that guy.
No, and that's why it's good that I have Rod as my partner. Right? Rod is very, I will come up with these ideas and he'll go, whoa, 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 dude, let's not jump yet. Let's kind of figure things out, right? And I mean that balance is really good for me. But on the flip side, my risk taking is good for him because right. I will push him in areas that he probably wouldn't do it. And so it's a good balance, but I still probably would take more risk than if he wasn't my partner. And that's just the reality of who I am, right? I'm just, I'm willing to build it, right? I'm willing to jump off the cliff.
Yeah. And you, I mean, you need,
I mean, literally,
you need both of those, especially in business yeah. and you know, actually in a marriage. I'm curious because my wife, I've been self-employed, like I said, since 98, 99. So I've been married 28 years. So most of our, you know, 24 of the 28 years that I've been married,
you got married in 89?
I got married in 95. Actually.
Oh, well, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So we got married in 95 and by 98, 99, I had already started my first business. So, Michelle, my wife, grew up with a father who was a firefighter, in LA at that time. They had a great retirement. So he did his 20 years. He did not want to move up into, you know, to be a captain or whatever. He just wanted to be what he wanted to be. I want to be a fire. So yeah. Like, Ozzie and Harriet, very low risk. Her mom is a super worrier about literally everything, which, you know, has its own things. But, you know, so Michelle is very risk averse. Like, she's very, you know, makes, is Judy that way? Which, you know, because that can, that can cause us some issues over time.
Yeah, no, my wife's, she's willing to take the risk with me. You know, it's interesting because before we started Zimware/RoadFS, we actually worked at another software company that went through 3 rounds of investment. And by the time the third round of investment, and I actually was over their national sales. I managed a team of 6 across the nation. And we built that company from our first sale of $29 to about a $6 million a year company. And by the time the third round of investment came around, I just was burnt out, right? And the CEO came in from New York, right? And I'll never forget, I was on a phone call and I had it on speaker. And he was, you could tell he was being really impatient, right? And then when I got done, he came back and he said, hey, I'd like to talk to you. So I go into his office and he's like, well, you know what? He's like, I've let the entire software development team go. I'm like, what? I go, wait a sec. And he's like, he goes, yeah, you know, we're going to do some restructure. And I go, wait a sec. You just let the entire development team go of the product that I sell. So what am I to sell? And he goes, well, that's not your concern. You just sell what I have. I go, whoa, 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 whoa. I go, the thing that you got to understand about me is if I understand your vision, I'm all in, dude. I've rallied everybody in this company. I will rally everybody around you if I tie into your vision. And he goes, that's not your concern. Your concern is to sell what we have and to make the company money. And dude, I went home really just frustrated and disheartened, right? Because I'd already been, this was already the third round, but I was also kind of hopeful as I tend to be. And I went home and I'm talking to Judy about it and just kind of venting. She goes, just do it. I go, what? Just do what? She goes, go start your business. You've been talking about it for the last year and a half. You guys go start a business. And so I went in the next morning and I gave my 2 weeks notice. And he goes, what, you're quitting? I go, yeah. I go, you have no vision. You can't articulate it. The only vision I see is that you're cutting everybody's legs out from under them. And I can't buy into that. And the ironic thing was, at the same time I was having that conversation, the VP of sales went over to my lead sales guy and told them that they were going to let me go. And and he goes, dude, you're freaking crazy. He goes, you don't understand the amount of sales that Jody's brought into this company. You're making a huge mistake. So literally me and the VP of sales literally cross paths as I'm going back to my office. And he goes, and I learned this after the fact, he goes, we need to rethink letting him go. He goes, well, he already quit.
Yeah. Nice.
So I went from a six figure salary to zero.
Been there. Yeah.
And overnight, and you know, and went 9 months without a paycheck and just started building out of my kitchen. And Judy was a big supporter of that. She's like, we'll figure it out. So
yeah.
Long story to a short answer.
No, I mean, I think that's, I love that because I said it in a way that would indicate that Michelle is not that way. She just comes at it from a more, oh crap, how are we going to do this? But I still support you standpoint. Than like, hey, I'm all in, let's figure out a way to make this happen. So I think with my adventures and cause I own 12 brands. And we've been through multiple, you know, we've had years where we've made multiple six figures. We've had years where we've made negative five figures or six figures. And so it's like, you know, so she's been up and down and over the years, you know, she's gotten used to it. But believe, you know, the great thing about wives that are that way is that you always have that security that someone values what you're trying to do for your family, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really important. I mean, I always felt, you know, and I still feel Judy's always got her back. She's like, all right, we'll figure it out. You know what? She's always like, we'll figure it out. Just keep working. We'll figure it out. So.
Well, so tell me about your Father's Fire podcast. I love what you do there. I've kind of been, you know, I had an opportunity to be on it, which was cool. And I've seen some of your guests and your topics and it's a really cool, very specific kind of podcast that I think is really feeding into a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, I started the podcast a little over 3 years ago and the impetus for creating the podcast was I was listening to another podcast where these two gentlemen were talking about their horrible experiences or lack of experience with their dad. And I'm listening to this podcast and I'm thinking about the narrative that we consistently hear about dads are deadbeats. They're absent, they're abusive, they work too much. And I'm like, dude, that was not my experience as a father, or as a kid, right? I had a dad, I'm the oldest of eight kids, I had a very involved dad. Yes, he was very demanding because he was in the Navy and he, you know, he had a bit of a temper. But
well,
man,
you got eight kids. You can't have chaos if you've got eight children in the house.
We were very regimented. I mean, I was saluting it too, right? And but my dad was, we were a very poor family, but he was very invested in, him and my mom were very invested in our family. And so I had a great role model as a dad. And so I'm listening to this and I'm like, man, there's got to be a voice for dads who are trying, right? And I'm trying to be a good dad. I have six kids and have so many experiences that I can tell out of my own experience as well as my experience with my dad. So that's how I started the podcast, was just talking about my experiences with my dad, lessons that I'd learned, things that I saw, lessons that I learned through the adoption process. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm going to start interviewing other men who I see are trying to be good fathers. So I specifically said, all right, God, show me men who are trying. And I don't care what their backgrounds are. So I've interviewed men in Scotland and all across in Mexico and all backgrounds, right? I have a really good friend out of Detroit. He's been on my podcast and he runs a program called Involved Dad that I help him with. And it's just been amazing because I've had so many just deep, deep conversations about addiction, about abuse, about neglect, about the hole that a father can put in somebody's heart because they're absent or they're abusive, but also the role that a dad can have in like launching you to incredible heights, right? And so what I've seen is that we're all trying to figure it out. There's no playbook for being a dad, right? And we're all trying to figure it out. But I think we haven't created a safe space for men to talk about their doubts, their struggles, their internal battles, whether that's just self-doubt, whether it's addiction, whether it's, you know, the trauma from being a kid, you know, and so I've just tried to create a space where we can have those kind of dialogues. And dude, every podcast, I learn something, touches my heart.
That's, yeah, I mean, I think that's awesome. I like the way that you present it as we're all kind of making this thing up and doing our best and trying is something that, you know, that we all do. I'm curious, as you talk to different people from different men from different cultures, do you find the same kind of struggles and issues and all that? Do you find those universal?
It's universal. It is absolutely universal. Every man that I have talked to has needed their dad in their life. And their dad has either been a hole in their heart or has been, like in your words from our thing, a launching pad for their life. And when you don't have that influence of a dad throughout your life, men really struggle. They really struggle to find their identity, to find a role model, to try to figure out how to be a man, how to be a dad, how to be a husband, right? Because they haven't had a model to emulate, and they really struggle, but they have this internal desire to become what they didn't have, and they're trying to piece it out. And so a lot of the men that I've seen that haven't had a good father model is they try to piece it together from different men that come into their lives, whether it's a coach or a professor or, you know, some kind of mentor. I mean, that, or somebody in their church, right? They try to piece these things together. And what I found too is on the flip side, men that had that good role model, they still struggle, right? But they struggle with different things, you know, and so, but I think it's universal. I mean, I think we all inherently want to be good men. We all inherently want to be good fathers. And we don't necessarily have all of the pieces. And that's okay.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I just had this thought of, you know, somebody in a foxhole that is trying to assemble a rifle and running around the foxhole trying to pick up all the pieces they need and not necessarily finding all the pieces they need because they need to do battle. Because really fatherhood is a bit of a battle with the world and, you know, trying to, especially now with our society. And I think this has been the case if you look at even, you know, 90s sitcoms. The dad is the bumbling idiot, you know, makes mistakes all the time, is not very smart, is weak, you know, and I think that's even over time has gotten even worse. So even like a pop culture model is the opposite. You know, I made a statement, somebody posted a picture on Facebook and they literally had the dad that was throwing the kid up in the air in the swimming pool. And I made the statement on that. I said, hey, you know, and this, I said something like, this is why we need dads in kids' lives. That simple statement. I got like three comments that said, well, it's not just dads, moms are important. And what about moms that are married to other moms? You know, all this. I'm like, dude, all I was saying is that you need a father to be there to do things that most moms don't, because, you know, I was amazed. I ended up having to just delete the comment because I was like, this is a ridiculous conversation.
Yeah. Well, and it shows that we have undermined the role of men as fathers. And it's sad, right? And I'm a big believer that one of the critical things of any society is the strength of the family. And when you have a father and a mother in the home and they're unified and they're driven by purpose around their family, you get a better, stronger society, right? And I get it, right? We have so many single moms. We have so many single dads. So we've really tried to shore them up and bolster them up. And yes, you can do this. But the reality of the situation is what we really need is a father and a mother in the home to create a foundation for these families. Do the others work? Yes. But I'm telling you, they're working like they're a three-legged stool. Mm-hmm. There's a core piece missing. And they're trying to play both. And I know it's not politically correct to say this, but they can't ideally fulfill both. They can try, and they do a great job of trying to fill the pieces in, but it's not the same.
No, I mean, we are, you know, men have innate characteristics as fathers that we bring to the table when we're raising children that, you know, women, like you said, can simulate that. And this is not a not, and, you know, and I'm going to keep going with this, but they can't duplicate that. And especially a father that is committed and earnest and wanting to make a difference in their family's lives. And on the same thing, if you have a single dad, they cannot, by very nature of who we were made to be, cannot duplicate the mom's role in a kid's life. It's just, I mean, you know, you've been married for a long time. I've been married for a long time. So we've had that, you know, more traditional, complete, what I would call complete nuclear family. And so you see just throughout that, like, you know, we had a kid that is, I have a kid that's bipolar, and she kind of is, you know, had those behaviors from the time she was a little kid. She had night terrors at 18 months. And we used to have to put her in the middle of the room, wrap her around pillows. And honest, we kind of thought she was possessed on a couple of these.
Oh, geez.
Because it was like, we could not restrain this child. And so that kind of behavior went through, you know, has gone through her life. She's got things under control now as an adult. But I tend to be much more hard on that and really not knowing how to have that softer, caring, calming side to myself. And so Michelle would say, hey, look, you got to leave the room. You know, you got to get out and yeah. to do that. Whereas, and then on certain cases, she, you know, we have this picture of my daughter in a little jumpsuit, like a tank person's jumpsuit, a mechanic's jumpsuit. We were actually out changing the oil when she was probably around that same time, actually 16, 17 months. And so I taught her how to change oil on a hot rod at that. You know, she's got oil all over herself. You know, she's using the tools and all this stuff. And that's something that, like, that's a very special memory and a special moment in her life. Not that women don't change oil. I live in a world full of automotive, welding.
Yes.
Trades women only. So, like, don't think I'm some misogynist out here saying that doesn't exist, but I'm saying that you need these different roles in order to have a complete, like you said, it's not a three-legged stool. You need a four-legged stool in order to be a complete situation. Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you're enjoying it and learning a lot. If you're looking for extra help, don't forget that I do offer one-on-one coaching. We can talk through a ton of different issues. I can give you guidelines and logistical help to help you take that next step or go to that next level in some of the things that you're dealing with in your life. We also have some course content, some guides, and a lot of educational materials over at maxedoutman.com. For the coaching, go ahead and go to maxedoutman.com/coaching and you can learn about that. And then just go to maxedoutman.com for everything else. Thanks for joining us. Now back to the episode.
Yeah. Yeah, it just makes a huge difference. And, you know, it's like you pointed out, my wife, she tempers the beast in me, right? Because I can be demanding. I can be very forthright, you know. And sometimes you need a gentler touch. And Judy and I have had to tag team back and forth. It's like, all right, it's time for you to step away, or it's time for you to step in. And I, you know, I've been very blessed to have that. And my heart aches for men and women that don't have that partner that they can do that. And dude, shout out and kudos to them for doing everything they do. But I just see in my experience, both in working with families and my own family, I just see that there's so much benefit to having, you know, that more of a nuclear family setup. It just, in the long term, it's so much more beneficial, especially when it's healthy.
Yeah.
A healthy, right? I don't want to emphasize that.
That's
a healthy.
That's a good one, right? For sure.
Because, dude, you can have a nuclear family that's worse than being a single mom or a single dad.
100%. Yeah. And, you know, and that's not, don't misinterpret my words that are, you know, those that are listening, that I actually grew up with a single mom. Unfortunately, my mom has drug addiction, alcoholism. And so I pretty much started raising myself at 6 or 7. I've talked about it on the podcast before slightly, but you know, that the single mothers and single fathers out there are just doing the absolute best that they can. And honestly, yeah, trying to make a life for the kids and provide for them emotionally and spiritually and financially and, you know, give that security. So it's, I can't imagine trying to do it myself. But statistically, even if you look at the statistics, it shows very definitively that as the nuclear family began to disintegrate, as you know, as we got more into a, what I would call a divorce friendly society, that all of these issues started to become more prevalent.
Yeah.
You know, you've got crime and teenage pregnancy and drug addiction, and like all of those numbers went up. And it's not a correlation versus causality. It's pretty much a causality situation.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
So tell me about this adoption. I think that you were in a unique position on this podcast because I don't know, you know, we actually just had a family in our church that adopted a little baby, a little girl, but it was in the United States. And so, you know, it's still a process. They had about 6 hours notice to fly out to Texas from Montana and go get this baby. You know, and so it was a different process. But take me through like how you were led down this path to adopt, having, you know, because a lot of times you kind of hear, oh, well, you know, we're not able to have children naturally, and so we want to adopt and all this. But like, you had a pretty big, you had a pretty full duffel bag of kids already, and then you made the decision to do this. So I'd love to learn more about that process and kind of the ups and downs and kind of what led you down that road and just everything around it. Honestly, I'm super curious.
Yeah, you know, when Judy and I first got married, we always intended that we were going to have our own kids, but in the back of our hearts and minds, we kind of knew that we would either foster or adopt down the road, right? So we were always kind of open to it. And then in about 2008, my wife got invited to go to Haiti on this trip with one of our friends in our ward. She was actually, her family was actually going through the adoption process, but they would go down there every 6 months and they invited Judy to go, and they would go and volunteer in the orphanage. And so Judy would go, they would weigh the babies, take care of them for a week, you know, check on the progress, you know, figure out what foods and supplies they needed at the orphanage. And just, it was a great time. Judy went there like 3 times, like every 6 months she would go. And my son actually ended up going on one of the trips as well. And that's a completely different story. I mean, that completely changed his life. But I remember she was going on a trip in in October. And the Sunday before she was supposed to leave on this trip on Monday, she woke up and she had a dream. And in the dream, she went to Haiti and she met this little girl that was just a little chatterbox following around, wouldn't leave her alone. And long story short, you know, she woke up and she told me about this dream. And I said, you know, if the dream plays out, then I guess we're bringing a kid home, right? And she goes, you know, but I think there wasn't a boy in the dream, but I think there's a boy as well. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, well, whatever. So, and I want to be sensitive because it was her dream, right? But, on Thursday that week, she calls me up and she said, she's just crying. She's in tears. And she goes, I go, what's up? She goes, I found her. I go, what do you mean? She goes, well, remember that little girl in my dream? Well, today, I met this little girl. She followed me all around. And, the piece that was significant about her dream was in the dream, at the end of the day, she brought, the girl back and she asked her name. And, the lady said something like Nerdly or Nertalu or Noodle. She goes, I couldn't get the name right. Mm. And, she goes, so at the end of the day today, I brought this little girl back and I asked her the name and they said, well, her name's Cincha. She goes, no, that's not right. She goes, what's her name? She goes, well, her name's Cincha Nertalus.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, the divine just set on her heart and she goes, I found her. And so I'm all right. So I started the process. While she was still waiting, I'm like, I started making all these calls. And when she got back, we started going through the background checks and the fingerprints and all that stuff, right? And we're about 2-3 weeks out from that experience. And the orphanage calls us and said, hey, Cincha has a brother that just got dropped off at the orphanage. Do you want him? So we're like, yeah, sure. So we were in the adoption process for 2 years. And wow. We were stuck in the first of 4 government agencies. And the person that ran the orphanage.
Haitian government?
Haitian government. And he's like, look, he goes, I could speed the process up. He goes, but... He goes, I'm trying to stop the corruption in our country. So I won't bribe. I won't go around the system. And I know it takes longer, but I'm not going to bend to the process. I'm trying to make it better here in our country. Hmm. And I'm like, okay, I can respect that, you know. And so we would go and we would go on these trips and visit the kids and come back. And that had, you know, I kind of have mixed emotions about that. Going there and coming back and, but eventually the earthquake hit, mm-hmm. the big one. And they're like, all right, because there was such a humanitarian crisis going on, they expedited all of the adoption for the children that were currently in the process in America, Canada, France, and they basically took all of these kids that were in the adoption process and expedited it and got them out of the country in an effort to relieve the chaos that was going on in Haiti. So literally they called us up on a Monday and they said, you need to be here in Miami on Friday to pick up your kids.
Wow.
So we had to move rooms, we had to get beds, we had to get furniture, we had to get clothes, we had to get airports and hotels. And I'm telling you, man, God just opened up the door. People donated hotel rooms, people donated airplane tickets. I mean, we had beds and I mean, it just all came together, but it was sheer chaos. Mm. And so we flew to Miami and went into this little I don't even know what it was. It's kind of this health and welfare kind of little hut. And we go in, we waited, they brought the kids in, and we took them to a hotel, stayed overnight, and flew them home. And I'll never, there was a really impactful moment. Actually, there were a couple, but one that just really struck my heart. We got on the plane, and as we're landing in Boise, our son, Ashton, was at the window looking out. And I could see in that moment, here was this little boy, 9 years old, and he's just been put on a plane. He's going to a place with two complete strangers, really. And he's going to a place that he's never been before. And the look of just fear, concern, what's going on, just it just stays in my heart, right? Mm. And in that moment, I'm like, all right, you know, I have a big job here because I'm dealing with a kid that's got a lot of internal emotions going on that he can't even process. He can't even articulate. And somehow I got to figure out how to be a bridge to this. And the whole journey of creating trust and creating a bond, it was a big, big process. And it's taken not weeks, not months. It's taken years to kind of work through that. And I think a lot of times people have this idea, and I get it, right? Adoption is a very beautiful thing, but you're bringing kids into your home, even as infants, that in some ways have had broken experiences. I mean, you think about an infant that is an unwanted pregnancy. Mm-hmm. A mother that wants her child, if you watch them, they will take their hands and they will caress their belly and they will pull up and in that baby into their heart, right? Whereas a mother that has an unwanted child or unexpected child tends to push away. And so even in infants, you can still have reactive attachment disorder. And that's a very real thing. And so,
hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you're enjoying it and learning a lot. If you're looking for extra help, don't forget that I do offer one-on-one coaching. We can talk through a ton of different issues. I can give you guides, guidelines, and logistical help to help you take that next step or go to that next level in some of the things that you're dealing with in your life. We also have some course content, some guides, and a lot of educational materials over at maxedoutman.com. For the coaching, go ahead and go to maxedoutman.com/coaching. And you can learn about that. And then just go to maxedoutman.com for everything else. Thanks for joining us. Now back to the episode.
Recognizing that as an adopted parent, that you need to not only create a safe and loving place, but you also have to create a space where they can work through their own loss, their own disappointment, their own building blocks of, all right, I need to build a relationship with you, and how do I do that? Mm-hmm. It's been an incredible journey, and it's exposed the good in me, the strong in me, the beautiful in me. But man, it's exposed the ugly in me as well. And I've had to go, all right, you know what? I got to be authentic. I wasn't at my best, and I need to be more than I was in that moment.
Yeah. And how did, you know, obviously as a family, it's, you know, fully disruptive. It's disruptive for the two kids that are coming into the family, but it disrupts every normalcy aspect of your existing family, right?
Yeah. You know, that's a really good point. Because here's the thing, you know, as we were going through the 2 years leading up to adopting, our family was really, really excited. I mean, the kids were excited. We were excited. We were in every way looking forward to having these kids come. And what we didn't anticipate was the trauma, the real trauma that was being brought into our home, because all of a sudden you're bringing children that are older. They've already had some connection with other people, and now they've been ripped out and they're being brought into your home, and your kids are now being displaced. And now I remember my son Zane, he was really excited. I mean, he was really excited. And then to have a son that was age-wise, he was 9, but emotionally he was about 4 or 5.
Yeah.
And so instead of having a little brother that he could connect with, all of a sudden he had this little brother that was annoying, and they didn't connect and they couldn't communicate because we had a language barrier as well as an emotional barrier. And so Judy and I had to be very cognizant of going, all right, we have our new children that have these needs, but now we have our existing children that have new needs that we've never had to deal with before. And so we became very purposeful in doing monthly dates with our kids. Now, she would take one kid, I would take one kid. And literally the first 2 years, Judy and I cannot leave the house without one of us being home. There was so much trauma going on, right? And so Judy and I have been religious about having date nights. Well, date nights got very creative. You know, we would go buy a big thing of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, and we'd go into a room and we'd watch a movie, or we'd make cookies. And, you know, my oldest son, you know, he was older. So once the kids were asleep, we would go for walks together and talk and commiserate and celebrate, you know, the triumph or the challenge of the day together. And so we had to figure out ways that Judy and I could come together and work through the things that we needed to do as parents, the things that we were experiencing on an individual basis and a couple. So it was a big adjustment across every aspect of the family, right? And I remember when we were going through the adoption process in Idaho, they actually, and I've shared this before in other podcasts, but when you're going through the process, they make you do parenting classes. And I'm like arrogant going, well, dude,
I got four kids.
What do you need? I need them parenting classes. Right. But I remember that, there was two sessions that I really remember, but this one, they showed these videos of these parents that have adopted and interviews with kids who are adoptees. And they were like the worst heart-wrenching stories I'd ever heard. And I'm like, I'm driving home. You know, one kid set fire to the house. One kid ended up committing suicide. The parent, you know, some sent the kids back. And I'm like, man, what the heck? I go, I'm driving home and I'm asking Judy, I'm like, what? Do they not want us to adopt? And I said something that became prophetic. I said, in love, all things are possible. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't realize was that while that statement is true, what I didn't realize, and I came to realize, that love is hard. Mm. And love is not truly tested until it's gone through the furnace of adversity. And so, as we have brought our kids together, we have had to learn how to love. They've had to learn how to love. They've had to learn how to trust, and vice versa. And Judy and I have had to be very purposeful in creating an environment where all of our children can work through their own personal doubts, their own personal trauma, their own personal loss, anger, sadness, excitement, happiness, joy, right? It's been this crazy journey. But in the end, the furnace of affliction has refined our family and made us something that is absolutely beautiful.
That's amazing, which is part of why your podcast is called Father's Fire.
Yeah. I want to ignite the fire within all of us to be better husbands and better fathers. Right. But it's really, true love is not realized until it's tested.
Yeah. And it's, doing marriage mentoring and counseling and all that. It's love is a verb and a choice. Right. Like the romantic idea of what love is does exist. You know, I still get those feelings for my wife and, you know, of course, but love in and of its core is an active choice that you have to make. And some days it's easier than others with our kids, with our spouse, with our coworkers and with society in general. And I think that's a really profound way to put that and going through that refiner's, in Christianese, we talk about refiner's fire, right? Like God takes us through these situations, or we go through these situations, and the process of refining is to burn out those impurities to help make us more pure. And I think that love, the idea of that love becoming more pure, is pretty amazing. I assume that you guys have kind of gone through guidance and counseling and all that along the way also, or is that something you're handling internally?
You know, our kids have, Judy and I haven't, mainly because we've had such a powerhouse in each other. Mm-hmm. And that's been very helpful, right? And we spend a lot of time in prayer together and counseling together. Judy and I have worked very hard to build a solid relationship. But our kids individually have had, counseling, and that's good. You know, maybe I should have had some counseling, but I think my podcast has helped a lot because I'm talking about things that are directly related, even though they're not exactly the same, right? And so I think in some ways the podcast has been my therapy as well. It's been good. I think one of the things, especially as I think back, if people are looking to foster care kids or adopt kids, I think one of the key things is that you have to recognize that these children are coming from broken situations. So they are going to be on high alert, mm-hmm. right? They're going to be on the defensive because the people that should have supported and cared for them have let them down. And they've had to rely upon themselves. And so you coming in and saying, I got this, is like, whoa, I've not seen that, right? And one of the things that really helped our family was we're big water family. We spend a lot of time in the boat, water mm-hmm. skiing and surfing and all that stuff, wakeboarding. And one of the things that really helped begin the process of trust was the first time that we took our kids out on the boat. Because, all of our four kids that were raised in our home, they got out, they're wake surfing, they're wakeboarding, and our two kids are going, hey, I want to try that. But there's a different thing when it comes to actually doing it. Mm-hmm. And so, I remember getting on the platform of our boat, it's a 3-foot platform. I'm standing there and I got Cincha on the edge and she's looking at, we're out in the middle of the lake, this dark water, And she's like, I'm not sure I want to get in this water. Right. Yeah, that looked fun, but I'm not so sure. And I remember, I'm like, I got you. Right. And so we sit on the ledge of the platform, and then I slip into the water, and I'm like, come here, I got you. Hold your hand. Right. And dude, she's still, and I'm in the water with my life jacket, and she's not, I'm like, I got you, you know, and look at me in the eye. I got you, man. I kind of half pulled her in, you know, and dude, I mean, she just grabbed my neck. I'm like, about choking me. Dude. I'm like, to breathe, relax. Right. And I push her away from me, and I'm like, look at me, I got you. Right. And so she was forced in that moment to 100% rely on me. Mm-hmm. She had to trust me. Right. And so we just sat in the water, and I'm like, look, the life jacket's got you. I got you. And I think that we rushed to try to make the connection instead of going through the process of connection.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, I kind of want to let that hang a little bit, but yeah, that building trust is got to be one of the biggest things. And for our own kids, I think I talked about on the podcast that my daughter again had talked him out. She had sent me a text for Father's Day and having that confidence and trust in me, and that no matter what, that I'm always going to get that to that ideal to say, hey, look, I've got you, right? You're safe to explore the world, right? And to learn these new things and to work past some of that trauma that you've faced and to go, you know, to do all of those things. But yeah, it's, that's gotta be one of the bigger challenges. And, I'm curious. So let's say that we got dads and moms that may be listening to this that are not going through the adoption process or have not had adopted kids. What have you learned from the adoption side of things and going through this with your two adopted kids that would transfer over to advice to give to dads, you know, that maybe just have a couple of kids, maybe have one kid trying to do the best they can?
Well, and I think, you know what, I think it applies to all kids, right? Especially, I think a lot of times, you know, when your kids are young, they trust you, they look up to you, you're their biggest hero, right? And then somewhere around 12, 13, 14, you become the biggest idiot in the world.
And the enemy in some cases.
And the enemy. And the most uncool dude in the world, right? And it's like they're embarrassed of you. They're annoyed by you, right? And I think that jolts a lot of dads because all of a sudden the whole dynamic has changed. Mm-hmm. But the principles are the same, you know, with being adopted or having your kids. All of a sudden they're working through who they are. Where they fit in. Are they loved? Are they respected? Can they trust you? Are everything that you've taught them in the past, does that make sense? Can I rely on that? Wait, everybody else is telling me I should do this, and that's not aligning with what I've been taught, right? And so the same, I think a lot of dads struggle because all of a sudden they're dealing with a stranger in their house. Mm-hmm. Because their kids are discovering who they are, and they repel against that process. When in reality, they need to know that one, they have a guiding post that they can always turn to. The problem is we tend to, instead of being the guiding post, be the beating post. Mm-hmm. And try to beat the craziness out of them instead of letting them embrace the process of growing and discovery. And I think a lot of dads struggle with allowing their kids space to figure out who they are and we try to put a thumb on it and go, no, and we try to squash them instead of going, you know what? It's just part of the process. And we all have that. We all, you know it. I mean, your kids are completely diabolically different, right?
Yeah.
And one's just like my daughter. I have that same daughter, you know, that is antagonistic and I'm reactionary, right? I have that, right? And we tend to, especially when we're butt heads, but the thing that helped us was I always said, look, I know we're not seeing eye to eye here, but I'm still here.
Yeah.
And I still love you. And I guess what? I need to say I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of dads really struggle with saying I'm sorry. I mean, I tell my kids all the time, look, you know I'm not the perfect dad. Surprise. I go, but I do love you, or I try to love you perfectly. Mm-hmm. And that means embracing the differences and where we don't get along, and I'm going to go along for the ride. And I think it's the same, whether they're adopted or their own, eventually you reach a point where they have to develop that trust in the relationship that you've built. And sometimes they have to rediscover it.
Mm-hmm.
And that rediscovery process can be painful.
Yeah. And it definitely, you know, when they were my girls, both when they were turned 14, you know, their heads are spinning around like Linda Blair, and, you know, and it's like, I don't know what to do with you right now. And the sheer, and my wife yells at me because I'm not allowed to say this to young parents anymore, but like, the sheer hatred that will come out of a 14-year-old's mouth is so surprising, because like, yes. And I'll say it to young, to parents, and it's like, just cause you want to kind of prepare them a little bit, but I tend to be a little bit extreme on it. It's like, kids will bring out, they have the propensity for the most love and joy and the most sheer meanness that you can ever experience. That's, and I, you know, obviously there are exceptions to that, but I think that most parents that I talk to that have gone through the teenage years, and we kind of had this fantasy like, oh, it's not going to be our kids and they're going to be perfect and all this stuff. And God has a sense of humor with that. But I always tell people that God made teenagers in such a way that they want to, you want them to leave the house as much as they probably want to leave the house. but having that support, and like you alluded to, my youngest, who's middle, you know, more, she's, I'm conservative, she's super liberal and antagonistic, and we have to have these conversations of like, look, let's back off on this. Our safe word is this, and kind of be able to tone those things down, and to be able to have an open and honest conversation to say, look, we're not going to agree on this. And there are certain ways that we can have this conversation that can have that and can be loving, but it doesn't do us any good to fight about, you know, economic policy in Ukraine or whatever.
No.
You know, free college tuition, or, you know, whatever those things are that tend to be the hot buttons of the day, but to have that launching pad. And I think that's great advice that you're giving to people. Last question. I've kept you for a long time, but I'm curious.
So
with my own marriage, and I think I don't know if I told this on your podcast, I've said it so many times, but I used to tell the girls, look, I'll make two more look just like you. There was a joke. I think Bill Cosby told that joke. But it's like, and they always knew that mom and my marriage was the foundation of our family. And I thought it was poignant then. And I, you know, and almost to an extreme to like, look, your needs are important, but you're not an infant anymore. So you can kind of sustain your life. But this thing over here with your mother is what the most important relationship beyond my relationship with God. That's very important. And I thought it was poignant that my youngest then, who I obviously have a little bit of antagonism with, she said that specifically. Thank you for showing me what it looks like for a man to love a woman. in that way. And I'm curious how your family and your relationship being married for almost 35 years, if that's been true, even going through everything that you do. You, like you said, you got the date nights once a week that I've been very religious about and very disciplined about. So I have a sense that you and I share those same ideals.
Yeah, you know, Judy and I actually have another podcast that we do together. It's kind of her brainchild. It's called Into the Gray. And it's where we're exploring kind of the gray areas of life, getting gray, our kids leaving, you know, all of that stuff. And in one of the episodes, she asked me, she goes, what do you think the most important thing is about our family? Mm. And I said, you. She's, I mean, it literally, I could see it. It took her back. I'm like, look, if you aren't preeminent in my life, obviously, right, you know, with God there, right? Yeah. If you are not preeminent in my life, in our life, then everything else falls apart. Mm-hmm. And that has just been a critical point in me, because I firmly believe that if you and your wife, you and your husband are not unified, nothing else works, right? And I see so many people go, well, the kids come first. I'm like, no, you and your wife have to come first, because guess what? Your kids are going to grow up and they're going to leave the nest, and you're going to wake up and go, who the... Yeah. Who are you? Right. It's like all of a sudden you're waking up to a stranger instead of going, all right, what do we get to do now together? Right. And I had a really good example in my dad. And this was a very poignant lesson for me. I remember very clearly, I was about 18. I was still at home, and my younger brother was going through this very, you know, he was 16, he was being a punk, just kind of everybody sucks and I'm the best. And man, he got in my mom's face. I mean, just was being disrespectful. And my dad walked in to the house and saw this. Mm. And he walked over and literally pinned my brother, took a hand around his neck, pinned him against the wall. It's the only time I really saw my dad lose his cool. And he goes, don't you ever talk to my sweetheart like that again. Yes, she's your mom, but first and foremost, she is my sweetheart. And nobody talks to my sweetheart that way.
Yeah.
And it just seared in my mind that, you know what? My mom is preeminent in my dad's life.
Right.
She is the angel of his heart. And I need to treat my wife with that same commitment, dedication, protection, love, admiration. And I have tried to be very, very purposeful in doing that with her. And I, you know, obviously I haven't been perfect, but my kids know that mom is before them. I mean, I've jokingly said, look, when you guys leave, mom and I's address is going to be a GPS location. Good luck. We'll come visit you, right? So, I mean, yes, I want to be involved in your life, but, you know, at the core, it's me and mom. And yeah, you and guys are part of our family.
Yeah, I think it's and so many couples miss that. I mean, I think that's why you see these, you know, we had a guy at church the other day that, I mean, he was married for 29 years and then he got divorced. And I'm like, first of all, the logistics of that and just the sheer, like, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be in my early 50s starting that over again. Like it seems just easier to make it work at that point. But in most cases, when we've seen that, it's a situation where you become mom and dad, you become, and in a lot of cases you become mom and then the dad becomes the provider and the golfer and the fantasy football guy and all, you know, all of those roles that he takes on. And you forget to be husband and wife first. So I think that, yeah. You know, I did a short form video the other day that basically said one of the ways that I really strive to tell my wife, you know, who she is by cherishing her. I use the word cherish, which is something that, you know, is so important. And I tell Michelle all the time, I wish you could see yourself the way that I see you, you know, because I think women oftentimes have, we all have self-esteem things, but a lot of times women do, and different women have it in different degrees. But I think that that's a statement to make sure that your wife knows how important she is to, in everything that you do. I cannot imagine a better place to end this, in terms of poignant place. I mean, I cried a little bit on your podcast. I cried on this podcast with you. I don't know if I could handle these things emotionally, but we'll have to do this again.
I'd love to do it. I mean, yeah. It's, you know, I love these conversations, right? Because I think we need more of this as men.
Yeah.
It's important for us men to open up, especially to other men, and go, you know what? This is what I'm struggling with. This is what I've done. This is what I've learned. Man, this is what's worked for me. Oh man, this really didn't work for me. And what have you done, dude? Cause I'm at a loss.
Yeah.
Right. And creating these kind of spaces where we can have these dialogues and share the things that are really the most important. I mean, yeah, we're both entrepreneurs and yeah, we have both have businesses, but at the core, the most important thing is the lady next to you and the kids that you guys brought into this world and get the opportunity to be parents for.
Yeah.
The rest of it's just minutia.
Yeah. Right. I say it all the time that don't get so busy trying to build money, success, all of those things, and forget that the whole purpose of those things is to build the life that you can have. And, Jody, I really appreciate your time. I'm interested. Can you share, like, if somebody's interested in the adoption, first of all, we want to know how to find you and learn more about you and your podcast, but also if someone is thinking about the adoption process, do you have a particular resource that you send them to?
You know, every state's a little different, so I would just look for a local adoption agency. You know, they'll be able to, you know, hear the one that we use. God, now I'm pulling a blank on their name, but they were great. I mean, they were just like, they had experience both locally as well as international. And so and that's one of the decisions that, you know, if you're thinking about adoption, do you want to adopt locally, internationally? Do you want to adopt older? There's so many nuances to it. And I just tell people, like, look, dude, God's going to kind of pull you if it's right for you. Mm-hmm. But recognize that love's hard. And it's going to be a journey. It's going to be a journey of love. And yes, they will be yours. And you will feel a connection that is unexplainable, that they are yours, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a process of also becoming yours, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, just reach out, you know, search your local adoption agencies. They'll be very helpful. There's a lot of different nuances if you're international versus local, but they're the guys that can help you there. So
nice. And how do we learn more about the podcasts and what you guys got going on?
So, yeah, so podcast is Father's Fire. It's on YouTube, Father's Fire. I have TikTok, my TikTok, Instagram. I have Jody Cedric and also Father's Fire. So either one. And I'm on Facebook. Just search Jody Cedric. I'm sure you'll find me.
and I'll put some links in the show notes as well. Hey, yeah. Man, I really appreciate your time. And this has been awesome. This is kind of kicked off a really busy day for me, but it's going to keep me, you know, it's been something that is, you know, poignant to me and important to me. And this connection and our friendship I love that it's going to continue to grow. So thanks so much, buddy.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, man.
If you're looking to really maximize your life and become the man you were made to be, head over to maxedoutman.com and get your journey started today.